Who's at the controls here? From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. We are about to talk about the celebration of the nuclear family, a very specific and at times very nuclear family. The Simpsons were first inflicted on the American public more than 30 years ago. They earned condemnations for coarsening the American culture, a devoted mass following, Emmys, and the endorsement of the Vatican. A longtime top Simpsons writer, plus the actor who plays Lisa Simpson, take us behind the scenes of the show and its creation. This hour, On Point, all things Simpsons. You can join us on air or online. What do you love about The Simpsons? Hate about The Simpsons? What's the secret to its longevity? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and on Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from NPR West in Culver City, California, is the writer and producer Mike Reese. He's a longtime creative force on The Simpsons and has won four Emmys for his work on the show. He was also a showrunner and head writer. He's here to talk to us about his new book, Springfield Confidential, Jokes, Secrets, and Outright Lies from a Lifetime of Writing for The Simpsons. Mike Reese, welcome to On Point.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Thank you. Let me ask you this. I remember seeing a documentary once in which Chuck Jones, the guy who's one of the key guys behind Warner Brothers cartoons and Bugs Bunny, he was asked, who'd you write these cartoons for? He said, did you write them for the kids or did you write them for the grown-ups? And he said, no, you've got us all wrong. We wrote this for ourselves. Who were you guys writing for?
Well, he took the words right out of my mouth.
Is that right?
When The Simpsons was starting up, I got the job there because nobody else wanted it. It's the same way I got a wife. I was not the first choice, but I was available. And I took the job, and I think I was like the fourth or fifth guy they had asked, and nobody wanted to work on it because it was a cartoon for adults on the Fox Network, which was a brand new entity at the time and had kind of a sleazy reputation, unlike today. And so I took the job and I didn't tell anyone what I was doing. And we just thought, this is career suicide. No one's ever going to see the show. We were so confident no one was going to watch it that we said, well, okay, if no one's watching it, let's just write the kind of show we wanted to see on TV instead of the kind of show we were seeing on TV. And we literally just had fun with it. It was a really fun summer job that's now in its 600th month, I think.
And you were taking characters that were in the Tracy Ullman show, a sketch comedy, and trying to blow it up into a show that would have a narrative and characters who would do more than just sort of amuse for 20 seconds here or there. What was that challenge?
That was a big challenge, and we heaped another challenge on top of ourselves. But these were 1 minute cartoons, and the cartoons are so rough, both in execution and sort of in conception, that even Fox has not tried to make a buck off of them. You know, you can't find these 1 minute shorts anywhere, but you watch them, and Matt Groening just had this astounding learning curve where they started off as very slapstick cartoons, and by the end, he had stretched them to 3 minute cartoons that just look like The Simpsons. They play like The Simpsons. The characters are all there, and not just The Simpsons family, but these 3 minute shorts had Grandpa and Krusty the Clown and Itchy and Scratchy. They're all in there. So he had really planted the seed. And then this just wunderkind of TV, Sam Simon, came in and expanded it, just expanded the canvas. And that's how it grew. The amazing thing, again, because I think we didn't think we would ever go beyond 6 weeks.
Or necessarily that Fox itself would survive as a new network.
Yes. I mean, it was very dicey. Or, you know, even if Fox did hang in there, who was going to watch it? So we packed the show. We had no artistic vision for the show or anything beyond, let's just jam this thing full of stuff because we're never going to get this chance again. And let's make it move as fast and as dense as we can. Because you got to remember, this is 1988, 89. The number one show on TV was Cosby. And this was a great show where nothing ever happened.
Mm-hmm.
And the closest thing to sort of irreverent, fast-paced comedy on TV at that time was The Golden Girls, which is just, you know, these four 70-year-old women shuffling from room to room. But that was about, that was the sound barrier for television at the time.
I want to play a clip from one of the episodes relatively early, 1993, called Last Exit to Springfield. I think you identify it as one of your favorites of the show, and it's considered to be one of the best episodes of all time. It's an episode in which Lisa needs braces. So Homer becomes president of the Springfield Nuclear Power Plant Union in order to win back the dental plan.
President of the union? I'm so proud of you, homie.
This is your chance to get a fair shake for the working man.
And make lifelong connections to the world of organized crime.
Do you think you can get the dental plan back?
Well, it depends on who's a better negotiator, Mr. Burns or me.
Dad, I'll trade you this delicious doorstop for your crummy old Danish.
Done and done. Don't!
Don't! So, tell us, Mike Reese, what makes that vignette, but more to the point, that episode a classic? What do you like about it?
Well, I got to be candid. It illuminates something about The Simpsons in that we never know how it's going to hit the public. I mean, virtually, the one point I'm making over and over again is we understand nothing. You know, we're just cranking out the show, and then it's the public that tells us how they like it, what they think of it. So, in that case, that's an episode where it was just one of a run in a long grind of episodes. We put it out. We said, that was okay. We moved on to the next one. And I think about 10 years later, USA Today called it the greatest Simpsons episode ever out of 300 episodes. And to that point, and I call up Jay Kogan, who wrote the episode. I said, USA Today just called Last Exit to Springfield the best Simpsons ever. And he goes, that wasn't even the best one we wrote that month. So,
At the time, was that one that stood out to you? I think,
if I recall correctly,
in the book, you sort of cited it as one of the best.
I decided, in fact, I told that story. I told, you haven't read the book, have you?
I have. Actually, okay. I did.
It's, it was a fun episode. Again, it was, I make the case in the book, the same case that we didn't know it was anything special. There were some great jokes we liked in it. But no, it was the public that told us this is the best. And it's, I watched it again, and yeah, it's very dense with all kinds of comedy. Even that clip you played, it goes from Homer making this very, you know, caustic political remark about, I can't wait to make friends with mob bosses. You know, very satirical line. And then 2 seconds later, he's just a moron trading a Danish for a doorstop.
One of the interesting things that strikes you as a viewer sort of subconsciously, but that you make explicit, is that Mark Groening, who's really, you know, the underground cartoonist who did Life in Hell, who then did the shorts on The Ullman Show and then is one of the creators of the show, he said that people on TV never seem to watch TV and that you guys decided to be sort of hyper-conscious of television, both as something that your characters would watch, but that also you would have constant allusions to it. What were some of the Easter eggs you guys were hiding in there?
Well, I mean, it starts off in the first minute of the show. The Simpsons are running into the house and they sit on the couch, and not everybody puts it together. They're sitting on the couch to watch TV. We cut to our opening title cards on a TV. So that's it. We're showing right off the bat, this is a family that watches a lot of television, which you never saw on TV. You still don't see it. People on TV don't watch television. And partly I know it's because it's a chore. If they're watching TV, then you've got to write what they watch on television too. So that's where that came from. And like a lot of things we do on the show, we took that from a really unlikely source, which is the movie 101 Dalmatians. Because you might remember 101 Dalmatians, all the dogs would sit there and watch television. I think they liked old Westerns. So a lot of it is just appropriations. And I think some of the most radical things we do on The Simpsons come from the most innocent places. I'll jump right ahead to tell you the whole idea of a couch joke. You know, we open the show with a couch joke, something, you know, something different and crazy and insane happens every single week when you tune on The Simpsons, which, again, unlike, let's say, The Cosby Show, where you were never shocked or surprised until, you know, 40 years later when you're reading the newspapers.
A very different kind of punchline and headline.
Yes, it was so... You were, TV didn't shock and surprise you, but here we were in the opening credits and you already did not know what to expect. And that's something we took from the Mickey Mouse Club, the 1950s Mickey Mouse Club. The opening credits would always end with Donald Duck hitting a gong and something horrible would happen. The gong would explode, or Donald Duck would vibrate all over the place, or he would be electrocuted. It changed every week. All that was consistent was it involved animal abuse.
Even that chord progression, is that from the Jetsons when you say the Simpsons in the opening credits?
I don't know. I'm not very musical. I never knew that. Certainly, our theme song is very much based on the Jetsons theme song. Just the way it changes chords and pace and key. And the way it underscores a bunch of different tableaus and a bunch of people moving towards one destination.
Got it.
Very Jetson-y.
All right. Well, we're talking with Mike Reese, one of the show's longtime writers and producers. We're talking about all things Simpsons. You can join the conversation. Simpsons fans, we want to hear from you. What burning questions have you held private about the show? Now's your chance. Here's the Monorail song, sung by Lyle Lanley and the good people of Springfield in the Season 4 episode Marge versus the Monorail. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
I hear those things are awfully loud.
It glides as softly as a cloud.
Is there a chance the track could bend?
Not on your life, my Hindu friend.
What about us Brendan slobs?
You'll be given cushy jobs.
Were you sent here by the devil?
No, good sir, I'm on the level.
The ring came off my pudding can.
Take my penknife, my good man. I swear it's Springfield's only choice. Throw up your hands and raise your voice.
Monorail!
What's it called?
Monorail!
Once again!
Monorail!
But Main Street's still all cracked and broken.
Sorry, Mom, the mob has spoken.
Monorail! 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 Monorail!
Mono, don't!
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes. Set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Hey, this is Stretch Armstrong.
And this is Bobbito Garcia, the hosts of What's Good.
We're back with a brand new season.
We've got Erykah Badu, Lenny Kravitz, Black Thought, and more.
You'll hear B-side stories from A-list guests. Subscribe now.
Who controls the British crown? Who keeps the metric system down? We do.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're taking a behind-the-scenes look and listen at The Simpsons. You just heard the Emmy-nominated song Stonecutter's Anthem off the 1997 album Songs in the Key of Springfield. You can join the conversation. What have you always wanted to know about Springfield? What hidden jokes have you discerned? What mysteries have you wanted unraveled? Why the heck do you keep coming back for more? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guest today is Mike Reese. His book is Springfield Confidential, Jokes, Secrets, and Outright Lies from a Lifetime of Writing for The Simpsons, which Mike Reese has done. I wanted to go quickly, Mike, to a call we've gotten from Charlie, a longtime Simpsons devotee from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Charlie, weigh in here.
Hi. Hi, David. Hi, Mike. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty well, Charlie.
I feel like I'm talking to, like, a rock star right now. You were my rock star, like, when I was growing up. You, Jay Kogan, George Meyer, Conan O'Brien, all you guys were my rock stars when I was growing up as a teenager. And I think you really helped shape my humor for the better. And when I was a teenager, I guess I was a little depressed, you know? And every day I would come home and I would watch The Simpsons every day for about like an hour, and it would just make me feel much, much better. And I've actually kind of memorized seasons 1 through 9, and even to today, I can talk with my friends, and we can bring up quotes, and we, you know, jokes, and we just laugh, and it's how I've made friends. It's a big part of my life, and I have a 7-year-old son, so now I'm kind of teaching him the ropes there too. And I just really wanted to thank you for all that you've done for me and for other fans out there. And I wanted to just see if you wanted to hear my Homer Simpson voice. I kind of worked on it.
Mike, you are not required in terms of your contract with NPR to listen, but if you'd like to, here he goes.
It was such a sweet introduction, and then I go, oh, I'm being set up. This is an audition. That was a beautiful, beautiful speech. Are you sure you want to wreck it by doing this?
I'm gonna take the risk. Ready?
Okay, roll with it.
Okay. The name's Homer J. Simpson. The J stands for Jay. There you go. And then I have one.
Dan Castellaneta, I think your paycheck and your career is secure. But Charlie, I appreciate this homage and also this bravery you've shown here. Mike Reese,
I'm going to jump in here because if I forget to tell this story, it'll kill me. Which was
do it.
It's a story I put in the book, and the editor wrote back to me. He said, "You can't just make up things and put in the book." And I go, and this happened about 20 times, and I go, this is absolutely true, when you may know it, which was in 2016, Ted Cruz is running for president, and there was a news story that the Fox was having trouble reaching an agreement with Harry Shearer coming back to the show. It's the first time we ever were on a little shaky ground reassembling the whole cast. So Ted Cruz, in the middle of his presidential run, cut an audition tape for The Simpsons. He wanted to do all the characters. He wanted to get Harry Shearer's job. And you can go on YouTube and look it up. Ted Cruz auditions for The Simpsons. And he also did Homer. So I can say, Charlie, yours is not the worst Homer I've ever heard.
That's great. I want to play you this clip because it gets at actually a related question. It's from season 8 of The Simpsons. It's the writers of the show within a show, The Itchy and Scratchy Show, attempted to update the cartoon by adding a new character. Here's Comic Book Guy's reaction to the new character, Poochie, who is voiced by Homer Simpson.
Last night's Itchy and Scratchy was, without a doubt, the worst episode ever. Rest assured that I was on the internet within minutes, registering my disgust throughout the world.
Hey, I know it wasn't great, but what right do you have to complain?
As a loyal viewer, I feel they owe me.
What? They've given you thousands of hours of entertainment for free. What could they possibly owe you? I mean, if anything, you owe them.
Worst episode ever.
So, Mike Reese, what do you guys owe your fans, whether it's people proclaiming worst episode ever or people who are explaining the meaning they take from the show, handing it on to their children?
Okay. Well, all I can say is whether you like the show, whether you don't like the show, if you think it's gone downhill, and I'll be the first to admit that every now and again we do a bad decade of shows, but you can never show me an episode or even a scene from The Simpsons where I can tell you we didn't work really hard on it. Sometimes things don't work out. Sometimes a story might not be as funny as we thought it would be or hit the public just right or a guest star doesn't work. For whatever reason, it doesn't work. At least I know we put in long, long hours. I did the breakdown on it, and pretty much it averages out to every single joke you see on the show was the work of 8 people sitting around a table for an hour. That's how it works out. About 100 jokes per episode, about 100 hours getting the scripts into shape.
Okay, so you guys work super hard, and like it sounds like you discard not 1 or 2, not 10 or 20, but you know, dozens or hundreds of jokes for every joke that actually makes it, right? But
that is correct. If you wrote the greatest script in the history of The Simpsons, by the time it hits the air, 80% of it's been changed, and very often 100% of it's changed. My whole job at The Simpsons for 30 years has just been sitting there going, Can we do a little better? Can we fit a little more in? Can this joke be a little funnier?
Speaking of lines, some of them have entered, you know, the lexicon, the common parlance, well outside the world of comedy. We have a scene from a 1995 episode that inspired a phrase that became ubiquitous after the U.S. decided to invade Iraq in 2003. It was aimed at France and other erstwhile allies in Europe. The setup, Bart feels ill at school. He walks into the nurse's office and he encounters the lunch lady and someone else as well.
Lunch lady Doris, why are you here?
Budget cuts. They've even got groundskeeper Willie teaching French.
Bonjour, you cheese-eating surrender monkeys!
That one then later graced the page, the front page of the New York Post in reference to France. The New York Post, of course, also a property owned by Rupert Murdoch. Do you guys know when you're going to get a phrase like that, that something's really going to pop?
Oh, absolutely not. Absolutely not. For the long, I mean, our most famous joke was the joke President Trump. It was the year 2000, and the setup for the joke was, I know you're probably getting it. What's the weirdest thing we can imagine America doing? And somebody pitched President Trump. So 16 years before there was a President Trump. And the point of this is, no one can remember who thought of that joke because it was just something tossed off among, you know, hundreds of rejected jokes that we generate every day. So no one even remembers who made the call on that.
This episode actually originally aired in 2000. It presupposes Lisa Simpson as president of the United States.
As you know, we've inherited quite a budget crunch from President Trump. How bad is it, Secretary Van Houten?
We're broke.
The country is broke? How can that be?
Well, remember when the last administration decided to invest in our nation's children? Big mistake.
Big mistake. Not a big mistake was casting Yardley Smith. She is the actor, comedian, and Emmy Award-winning voice of Lisa Simpson. Yardley, welcome to On Point. You're joining us now from Los Angeles.
I am. Thank you so much for having me.
So tell me a little bit about how Lisa evolved, at least from your vantage point, from the brief character in the sketches of the Tracy Ullman show to what we think of today.
Well, I actually was told that I know that when I originally auditioned for the part, Lisa was really just a foil for Bart. They told me she's his bratty younger sister, and I am a bratty younger sister, so I was like, oh, okay, I get that. And then when we spun off into Half Hour, I was told that Jim Brooks, who's our executive producer, said, I want Lisa to be a saxophone prodigy, and I want her to be super smart. And then subsequently I learned that Matt Groening believes that Lisa Simpson's the only one who would get out if the Simpsons ever actually truly aged. I mean, I've been 8 for 30 years, so the chances are it's not going to get any better than that, which is awesome. And then there's so much to mine from just those two directions, or three,
just,
really.
Just jazz and being smart.
Yeah, yeah. And the one who's going to get out. That's a lot of, that's a pretty rich buffet, wouldn't you say, Mike?
I definitely would. I don't know if you heard earlier in the interview, but the point I keep making is everything people love about The Simpsons, somebody did it somewhere earlier. We just picked from 1,000 sources, and I go, the one unique thing about The Simpsons is Lisa Simpson, is Yardley Smith doing Lisa Simpson because she's the heart and soul of the show, and you've never seen in cartoon history a character so vulnerable, someone who just tears at your heart on a scene-by-scene basis, especially a child character who's so rich and layered and full of, you know, pain and hope. So she's the magic ingredient.
Well, there's a line in the book, in fact, Mike Reese, where you write something along the lines of, we were all Lisas in the writer's room, hardworking and not Barts.
Yeah.
You know, we all
would have loved to be Bart, the writers, when they were kids. They were all Lisa. They were all just kind of pained and neurotic and wished they had friends. And then one day, suddenly, we woke up and we were all Homer Simpson. We were all angry and paunchy and losing our hair. And the proof of that is, Simpsons writers can make their schedule any way they want, but everybody wants the work on Friday. And the only reason is Friday's the day we get free donuts.
You know, you got...
Stop it!
It's true! See, nobody believes my story.
Much least the people who know you best. We have a couple of clips from involving Lisa, and it's interesting. You talk about this, you know, Seinfeld famously, you know, no hugging, right? And you think about this, the Simpsons as being a place that at times can be quite cynical and at times can be, can undercut sincerity. And yet there really is sincerity, particularly around Lisa. I want to play a couple of clips. One of them, let's go with the one from Moaning Lisa. In season one episode called Moaning Lisa, she began to express herself by playing the saxophone, as the legendary producer James L. Brooks suggested to you, Yardley. That was to the chagrin of her music teacher, Mr. Largo.
Lisa, there's no room for crazy bebop in my country, 'tis of thee.
But Mr. Largo, that's what my country's all about.
What?
I'm wailing out for the homeless family living out of its car. The Iowa farmer whose land has been taken away by unfeeling bureaucrats. The West Virginia coal miner coughing...
Well, that's all fine and good, but Lisa, none of those unpleasant people are going to beat the recital next week.
I also want to play a little segment of the episode Lisa versus Malibu Stacy, in which Lisa becomes distressed at the effect that a Barbie-like doll might have on other young women.
Millions of girls will grow up thinking that this is the right way to act. That they can never be anything more than vacuous ninnies whose only goal is to look pretty, land a rich husband, and spend all day on the phone with their equally vacuous friends talking about how damn terrific it is to look pretty and have a rich husband.
Yardley Smith, what did it mean to you to play this character?
Oh, everything. I really, it's 100% true that Lisa Simpson would be one of my favorite characters created. Really across all mediums, even if I didn't play her. I think that I so admire her resilience. I love that she has such a wicked sense of humor. She really is, she's the best aspects of what a person could be. And I always say she's who I wish I had been at 8 and who I wish I were at 53. She is, she just never loses her hope and her ability to strive to do better, despite the numerous setbacks. As Mike says, she never gets to keep any friends. No matter what they give her, by the end of the show, 22 minutes later, they've taken it away. And yet Lisa Simpson just soldiers on as though tomorrow is another day. it's pretty remarkable.
We just looked at an episode yesterday. It had just come back in animatic, rough animation form, where Lisa gets a really great new friend. And I hadn't worked on this one, and I'm watching it, and Lisa keeps saying, when am I going to lose her? This can't last.
Yep.
She walks into their home with a farewell gift, and it ended. That's our shocking surprise ending, is they don't go. She keeps her friend. It was such a nice treat.
Let me quickly just take a call from Steve from Dayton, Ohio. Steve, go ahead.
Hi, how you doing today?
Good.
Hi, Steve.
Hi, it's a pleasure to speak to you. I'm a longtime fan of The Simpsons, and I was just curious, is there a certain episode that you can remember in the 30 years that you did at the time and you wouldn't be able to get away with that content or that storyline or a certain joke nowadays?
Mike Reese, why don't you weigh in on that? You've in about a minute left that we have in this segment.
Quite literally, no. The answer is no. I can't think of it. And the proof is they do keep rerunning them, whether they're apropos or not. They keep showing these old episodes. And we don't hear any complaints about him. Obviously, we did a whole episode set at the World Trade Center, and it was a classic episode. Simpsons go to New York, and after 9/11, they pulled the episode off the air, pulled it out of syndication for 2 or 3 years before they thought people were ready to laugh at it again. And they put it back, and again, it's just... people get the context, they get the history of it, and it is one of people's favorite episodes, and now it has kind of beautiful nostalgia value, too.
Every now and then the censors will ask you to reconsider a line, but it sounds like you're given a lot of leeway there.
It is, especially now. You know, we're on before Family Guy. They've got much bigger problems on their
censors
hands.
Censors have other problems on their hands. We're discussing what it's like to work on The Simpsons. Mike Reese and Yardley Smith, stick around. And folks, you too can join our conversation. What's your favorite moment from The Simpsons? What does the show mean to you? Here's Simpsons character Mr. Burns singing See My Vest about his plot to turn puppies into, and forgive me folks, a tuxedo. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. Underwear, turtle's necks, I've got my share, beret of poodle on my noodle itchel wrist. Try my red robin suit, it comes one breast or two. See my vest, see my vest, see my vest. Like my loafers, former gophers, it was that. A skin my chauffeurs, but a greyhound for tuxedo would be best. So let's prepare these dogs.
Kill two for matching dogs.
See my vest, see my vest. Oh, please, won't you see my vest?
So you just woke up. And you want to find out about the latest news? That is when you turn to Up First, the 10-minute news podcast from NPR News. Here, Up First on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're talking about what it's like to work on The Simpsons. You just have heard, of course, the classic song Spider Pig from 2007 movie The Simpsons Movie. You can join the conversation. When is Maggie going to talk? Where the heck is Springfield? I don't know. Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. We're talking to Mike Reese, longtime writer and producer of The Simpsons, and Yardley Smith, the voice of Lisa Simpson. Guys, you know, there's one issue I do want to address with both of you. Recently, the fellow cast member Hank Azaria, the voice of the Simpsons character Apu, responded to criticism about how his character portrays Indian Americans. Obviously, it was the subject of a documentary in recent months. Hank was speaking on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert back in April.
I really want to see Indian, South Asian writers in the room, not in a token way, but genuinely informing whatever new direction this character may take, including how it is voiced or not voiced. You know, I'm perfectly willing and happy to step aside or help transition it into something new.
Mike Reese, in the book, if I'm not mistaken, you say, look, the character really has been scaled back in recent years anyway. And you seem to sort of at once acknowledge that people may find it offensive, but also the argument you seem to be making in some ways is, look, everybody in some ways is made fun of, and yet everybody in some ways has a certain sense of dignity about him or her. How do you think back about the character and the controversy that bubbled up and the apparent offense that some Indian Americans took to this portrayal?
Yes, I want to say first off, because we take this really, really seriously, because we're not one of those shows who likes to offend or shock, or we certainly, you know, we love our viewers and don't want to lose them. But yeah, we don't want them feeling offended by the show. And for the longest time, I think this is all partly we're just sort of victims of our longevity, in that when Apu came on, I used to hear from Indians how much they loved the character. And part of the reason was he was the only Indian on television. He was the only representation they had. And now you see lots of Indians on TV.
So that in that moment, you know, you're saying that people kind of are taking what they can get. But you still feel as though it seemed to me, and forgive me if I'm getting this wrong, but from what I read in the book, you didn't feel as though the character itself was offensive or was intended to be demeaning in any way.
That is correct. I mean, I always liked him. He was the only man who worked hard in Springfield. He was the only person who cared about his job. And he, you know, there are stereotypical elements to him like every single other character on the show. Times have changed, perception has changed, and yeah, we don't want this to be a problem. We don't want people. It's the same way we didn't show an episode with the Twin Towers in them. We don't want people distracted, taken out of the moment, or or hurt by the character.
Sure.
And so, what I do like to say is, we wrestle with this every day. We follow what's being said on the internet and, try to get all the feedback we can. I've never heard a clear answer what to do. I would love someone to come in with that magic formula that's going to make everyone happy. Here's what I think we should do. My pitch is that we take a whole episode, we devote it to this topic, we hit it head on, we have an Indian actor on the show discussing it with Apu, and then we just slowly, kind of without grandstanding, sideline and bench the character. That would be my plan, and that's something we did 2 years ago. We did it already. We did it long before this documentary came out because we were aware of this problem. Huh. So for all the complaints about Apu, we can't undo the past, but you haven't heard him on the show in 2 years. He hasn't. You hear the guy who made the documentary on TV talking much more about Apu than you actually hear Apu.
Sure. Yardley Smith, I wanted to play a cut. One of the things that the show often did was it incorporated music from the themes, from some of the songs we've been playing today, and from having people in, sometimes actual celebrities and sometimes people sort of riffing off them. We have a cut from a song on one of the episodes. The song is called Cut Every Corner. It's from The Simpsons' Mary Poppins parody, and the send-up is of the song A Spoonful of Sugar. In the Simpsons world, the British nanny is named Sherry Bobbins.
If there's a task that must be done, don't turn your tail and run. Don't pout, don't sob, just do a half-assed job. If you cut every corner, it is really not so bad. Everybody does it, even Mom and Dad. If nobody sees it, then nobody gets mad.
It's the American way.
It's the Simpsons way, to use a lot of music in the shows. Yardley Smith, what did you get out of it? What did the show get out of incorporating so much music into what it did?
Well, I do think that it's unusual for a cartoon to incorporate so much music, especially so much original music. Jim Brooks he insisted when we first went to half-hour series that the show would be scored, each episode would be scored by a 40-piece orchestra, which is both expensive and time-consuming, and Fox, because he's James L. Brooks, said, sure, that's no problem, and we still do it that way. Mm-hmm. I would say as a non-singer who sings a lot on the show, one of the hardest things they make me do is sing parody songs like that, because the tune is recognizable, but it's not actually what you grew up learning the song as. It's slightly off, and if you're not an actual musician, this will really, really mess with your brain. You're like, oh, I'm so close, because the notes are so close, but they're not. Oh, it's really hard. I feel like for a proficient musician, you'd be like, yeah, no problem. For me, it's a hellacious session.
It's funny. We keep doing it to her because she's got the best singing voice on the show.
By far.
Yeah.
Two of these episodes that always stuck with me actually stick out with me in part because of the music. The monorail episode, we heard an excerpt of the famous song from that. There's also the Sideshow Bob recreation of Cape Fear, which just gets me every time. And there's this moment at which, Bart has been, he's basically been kidnapped. He looks like his life is in peril. Sideshow Bob, Kelsey Grammer, menaces him and says, essentially, do you have any last requests? And he says, yes, I'd like to perform the entire libretto of HMS Pinafore, and they do. Mike Reese, what the heck were you guys doing?
What's been great is maybe two-thirds of the clips you've played during the hour are musical numbers. And the reason we do so many songs on the show is they eat up time.
You're just that lazy that you force everybody to come up with a new song and score it and everything else.
You have to trust me on this. You know, other people look at the show as maybe a work of art or creative collaboration, and we look at it as a 22-minute hole that we just shovel jokes into every week. And when we...
It's a big, fat lie, Mike Reese.
It is...
Call him on it.
How dare you? How dare you? How dare you call me not lazy? No, it's... It is absolutely true that, as I mentioned before, we rewrite every joke 8 or 9 times in the show. When we write a song for the show, it never changes. We don't change it. We never cut it. So we love it. You know, when we stick a song in the show, we go, well, there's 5 minutes we don't have to think about again.
Thanks a lot.
All right. We've got to release you, but that's Yardley Smith. She is the Emmy Award-winning actor, a comedian, a brilliant figure as Lisa Simpson on The Simpsons. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, David. This is Lisa Simpson. Yardley had to go, but really appreciate you having me on the show today.
Thank you both.
Thank you, Yardley.
All right, Yardley.
Bye.
We'd now like to turn to Delafield, Wisconsin. Artist, you're on the air with Mike Reese.
Hi, Dave.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call. And Mr. Reese, I love the show for 30 years. Interestingly enough, my husband and I, we were married May 3rd of 87, which was just a few weeks after, I think, the first short aired. And people always joke that, well, what happens when they go off the air? Are you guys, like, going to get divorced or something? So
it's kept the magic alive.
So. My whole, even in my house, our den has a big poster of The Simpsons on their purple couch. And then in front of that is our purple couch.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah. But, I think my favorite episode is the chili cook-off where Homer ate the Guatemalan insanity peppers with John. I think it was with Johnny Cash. And then... my favorite Homerism was when he told he was dressed in a Confederate Civil War uniform, and he said they were doing a reenactment, and he said to Apu, "We need a lot of engines to shoot." And Apu says to him, "What? I don't know what part of that sentence to correct first."
Well, it's we appreciate your call and your sharing that. Mike Reese, we have another caller from Raymond, New Hampshire, excuse me. William, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes, I wanted to know if your guest or any of his colleagues had been influenced by the Rocky and Bullwinkle cartoons of the great Jay Ward and Bill Scott.
The answer is maybe more than anything. Maybe more than anything. There's a few things we can all point to, like Monty Python, we all loved. We all did watch the Flintstones. But I would say Rocky and Bullwinkle may be the number one influence on the show. And especially the fact that it was my favorite cartoon when I was a kid. And part of what I loved about it was I knew I wasn't getting all the jokes. You know, the show, I know the writers of the show got a look at the animation, and the animation I think was done in Mexico and was so simple and spare. They said, we better write the hell out of this show because there's nothing much in the animation style. And so that show was just filled with jokes. You know, it was Cold War satire. My favorite joke that nobody gets is that the villain is named Boris Badenov, which, of course, is a pun on Boris Godunov, the consort to Catherine the Great. I mean, it's full of that level of comedy. You're throwing it at kids and just knowing it doesn't matter if they get it or not. They're going to get that there's something they should get. And we do it in The Simpsons all the time.
Thank you so much for that call. Mike, I wanted to play a clip of Homer in season 16. You guys often have very famous people come on the show for brief cameos, sometimes, I guess, not so brief cameos. Here Homer's talking to a Catholic priest who's voiced by Liam Neeson and they're talking about the sacrament of confession.
Wait. No matter what I did, no matter how many people lost their pensions, it's forgiven like that?
If you truly repent, then yes.
Okay, let's make some magic here. I wiped a booger on your shirt. I made a dog and a cat kiss. I swiped a bolted down TV from a Holiday Inn.
That's quite a list to repent for. Mike Reese, did the folks coming in always get the joke? And if they did they always like the joke?
Yes. We've had close to 800 guests on the show. I'm amazed at the clips you pull, because Liam Neeson may be our favorite guest star out of the 800 guests we've had. He just came in. He was a ton of fun. He got it, and he was funny. I think that's one thing actors love to do about coming on The Simpsons is they show, you watch Schindler's List, you don't think, this guy's going to be hilarious. But he was so funny on the show. And I think they like to show, look, I can make fun of myself. So
sure.
I forgot the question now.
Well, I was just saying, did they always get the joke, and did they always like it if they got it? I remember reading in your book, you said basically Johnny Carson said no and was offended by something you suggested initially, and then he was delighted to come in when you made him the hero of the episode in another one.
Yes, that's almost a unique case where Johnny Carson, I used to write for Johnny Carson, and I got fired by Johnny Carson. And then a few years later, I heard from people who hadn't been fired by Johnny Carson, he wanted to do The Simpsons. So we wrote him a part right after he retired where he came around to The Simpsons and basically had nowhere to go. He had no more show. And so he became like the bad brother-in-law. He was just sleeping on The Simpsons couch and eating the last piece of pizza and drinking Homer's last beer. And wow, Carson hated that. And so
such a funny bit, though.
It was really funny. I think the staff had given up. They go, all right, we blew our shot with Johnny Carson. And I said, what if we go the other way? What if we make him insanely great? You know, on top of being this masterful comedian, why don't we have him sing opera and juggle a Chrysler? And that's what we did. We animated him as a superhero. And then he loved it. He came into the show, and we actually had trouble getting rid of him. You know, he came in, he recorded his part in 5 minutes, and then he just sat around shooting the breeze for the next 2 hours. And it was a joy. And it's the one of maybe two or three things he did after retiring from The Tonight Show. So it was a great send-off for him.
It didn't hurt that you had Conan as one of your lead writers as well.
It never hurt that. No, Conan never hurt. Conan was our first new writer we hired. We had the same group of six or eight guys for the first three or four seasons. And then some people left to try and do their own things. And we needed a new writer. And this was going to be a very hard slot to fill. And I said, Conan, gee, I know this really crazy guy named Conan. Let's give him a shot. And he walked in
and he
took over the show and wrote the monorail episode.
And he may have something of a future for himself, too. Well, we've been listening today to Mike Reese. He's the author of Springfield Confidential, the longtime writer and producer of The Simpsons. Thanks, Mike, for joining us.
Thank you.
You can continue the conversation and get our podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Here's Green Day performing The Simpsons theme from the soundtrack to the 2007 The Simpsons movie. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.